Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we present the second of three panel discussions presented by Boston University's African Studies Center and the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. The discussion, entitled Reinventing Liberia, features the Reverend Dr. Thomas Hayden, former Liberian missionary and schoolteacher and current head of the Society of African Missions, Dr. Patrick Sion, former president of the University of Liberia, and Her Excellency Ruth Sando Perry, former interim president of Liberia and current president in residence at the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Introducing the panelists again tonight is Dr. James Pritchett, Associate Director of the African Studies Center at Boston University. Dr. Pritchett.
My name is James Pritchett. I'm the Associate Director of the African Studies Center here at Boston University. Let me welcome you to the second of our three panel discussions on rebuilding Liberia. We have assembled a wonderful panel for you. Unfortunately, the long Boston winter has taken its toll, and one of our guests, unfortunately, will not be here. The National Chairwoman of the United Nimba Citizens Association, Mrs. Kwipu Maiwan, will not be with us tonight. We do have, however, to my immediate right, my colleague, research fellow here at the African Studies Center, Patrick Sion. Patrick received his PhD from Stanford University. And to his left, we're very happy to have with us tonight Reverend Thomas Hayden, Ted Hayden, who received his PhD in Anthropology and African Studies from Howard University, whose relationships with Liberia goes back at least as far as 1959 when he was a missionary parish priest, a secondary school teacher, and a university lecturer at Cape Palmas in Liberia. To his right, of course, our honored guest, our deeply honored guest, the former interim president of Liberia, the current APARC Lloyd G. Balfour African President in Residence, Her Excellency Ruth Sando Perry. Thank you to all of you for being with us tonight. I think we will begin with Ted Hayden.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pritchett and Dr. Sion and Madam President, Mrs. Perry. I'm going to talk about the social structure of Liberia. I know Dr. Sion is going to talk about the political, and of course, like any two areas, there's a much overlapping there. I begin with a kind of an anecdotal introduction. I remember coming to Cape Palmas in 1959. Cape Palmas is one of the most beautiful parts of all of Africa. It's a small peninsula jutting out into the Atlantic Ocean where one can see the sun rise from Cote d'Ivoire in the morning and the sun set in the evening, palm trees, beautiful ocean, nice breeze. A beautiful town of perhaps at that time of about 15,000 people. When I arrived and was there, I was pleasantly surprised at what I thought was a well-developed small town. We had electricity, running water, we had a post office, we had a Firestone plantation employing people. There was foreign international companies, merchants there. And there was a very, very good educational system. There was Fatima High School, where I taught, and there was Bishop Ferguson, which was run by the Episcopalian Church, and Cape Palmas High School. Students from those schools, when they graduated, they came to the United States and managed to move into top-notch universities without any difficulty. When I went back there in the year 1999, I see there was no electricity, no running water. There's no post office. The nearest reliable post office was in San Pedro, Cote d'Ivoire, over 100 miles from Cape Palmas. The school system was in an absolute shambles. There were no books. The teachers, most of the top-notch teachers had either retired, ran away as in exile as refugees, or were killed. So the teaching system there, the schools, is completely deteriorated. So after you take a 40-year interval, Liberia, Cape Palmas, from a very, very progressive small town to one that is absolutely devastated in every single section of the social and economic structure. And I think that is probably a microcosm for all of Liberia. One of the difficulties in Liberia is that the population there, the majority of the population, have no experience of a civil society. If we take the normal projection that 50% of Africans are under 20 years of age, and they have had roughly 20 to 25 years of civil war, of military or quasi-military authority, very, very few people, perhaps only 10 or 15% of the people who are adults now in Liberia have any experience of a stable civil society. Also, the youth, there are no role models. It's very, very difficult when people of, say, 20 or 30 years went by, they had all types of role models, doctors, teachers, merchants, and if you were in the political area, they had politicians that they knew that were there somehow in some type of an elected system, even though it would not pass kind of the major tests of free and fair elections, but there were people there that were represented that way. Now all of the people in power are there because they got there through the use of force. The economic infrastructure of Liberia has been completely destroyed. When I was in Cape Palmerston in the early 60s, Firestone was had a 10,000-acre rubber plantation. It's a very good employer because it uses a lot of non-literate people, but it also had people working the factory camp, into the hospital, in the administration. And the logging companies, and later they had the sugar plantations, that all brought a steady flow of money into the county. Now in Maryland County, where Cape Palmas is situated, the only economic enterprise there is logging. And logging, all of the revenue from the logging, none of it comes back to Cape Palmas. The only little bit of the money comes into the economy through wages. So the unemployment rate in Cape Palmas would hover around 90%. Very, very few people have any job. Now, those are rather negative ones, but I see some very, very positive signs in Liberia. And there will be people, I'm sure, that will dispute this. I think that Liberia did not have a history of ethnic warfare. That does not mean that people always got along well together, but the disputes that you would see, like in Sudan or in Nigeria, those types of disputes did not come. They only were really inflamed in Nimba County when Doe came in and started the ethnic conflict between the Kran and the Dan, or properly known as the Gio. That's when the ethnic rivalry came. But that was not there prior to that. That does not mean there was always peace and tranquility, but strong ethnic rivalries did not exist. The other thing is religions does not play a significant role in Liberia in terms of controversy. We see this in, unfortunately, very, very strong in northern Nigeria. We see it on a different plane in Sudan, where it's a more complex difference. But in Liberia, they don't have it. Liberia has one. They have the Liberian Christian Council, which is of all a Christian church, but they also have an interreligious council. And the interreligious council composes the Muslims as well as the Christians. And they work together, and at times, sometime it will be a Christian minister or a Muslim mullah who is in charge. And they work together. One is not to let Islam and use Islam and Christianity as a wedge of trying to bring conflict in Liberia. And it's on a very, very practical basis. When Alhaji Kroma tried to make it that the Mandingo people were being persecuted and killed by the Krans and the Gios because, that he said, because they were Muslim. and people like Hassan Conti, many of you know him, a geographer working in the university, a Muslim. He and others, they cut that right off at the knees, saying that is simply not true. Why? Because the Vai people and the Gola people have large portions of those populations have been Muslim for hundreds of years, and none of those were killed in this so-called conflict against the Muslims. So Alhaji Chroma lost his major playing card because the really interreligious differences are not at the conflict level. And I think that's a real step forward for the people of Liberia. I think it is the only African nation that has a national, say, social justice group that comprises both Christians and Muslims on an equal basis. For 10 years, I ran a boarding school in Cape Palmas. There were all people from the rural areas on the Kru Coast where they had no high schools came to Cape Palmas to go to school. I would say maybe once in a year that you would get a fist fight. They would argue, and these are all teenagers ranging from 14 to 20 years of age, living together, there was none. Last year when I was in Cape Palmas, I noticed two groups of small children, maybe 10 or 12 or 14 years old, boys fighting. The first thing that happened is have to be very, very careful how we use the word boy, because we use a boy here and a boy in Liberia, but bigger boys or young men came and they automatically separated them. In Cape Palmas, when I was there for 2 years, from 1999 until October 2001, I was there for the famous 9/11. There was hardly any violence at all in town. The only time violence began to come forward was when the SOD, the Special Operations Division, and the ATU, the Anti-Terrorist Unit, when they came to town, crime went on the upswing. But before they arrived, and this was at a meeting, a mass meeting at City Hall of all of the citizens. They came to complain about the violence in town, and they came to complain about the violence of ATU and SOD against the people. They, by themselves, were able to manage to keep the place peaceful. So I'm very, very optimistic that if we can get a civil society going, that the absence of religious differences and the idea of nonviolence comes forward, I think we can have a really civil and a peaceful society. I did my, just as a kind of a side story, I did my PhD thesis on Grand Cess and the Kru Coast and on social change. And part of the research was doing a little bit of history. Grand Cess and Picanini Cess people side by side. And they told me when I did the history, they had a war. They had a war over farmland. They said it was a big war. I said, how big? Oh, they said, plenty of people killed. I said, how many were killed? They said, four people on their side and six people on our side. After that, they settled it. They decided to settle. They went to negotiation, and they settled who was going to have the land. So maybe the historians can give you a different perspective. But my own, from a social science, an anthropological point of view, I do not see a history of violent resolution of disputes. Now, we take just some of the areas on the social situation. There's no need to go into it. The schools are in just terrible, terrible shambles. And once you try to get them going again, it deteriorates. A group of Liberians sent out a whole container with books for the whole county. They put new blackboards and chairs in the schools. During this most recent lured Model, a group in Cape Palmas, they even took the blackboards off the school. What they can do with the blackboard, because you take them off, they're destroyed. But again, there is nothing there. All the desks, all the books, everything is taken. So education is terrible because the students don't have good teachers. They don't have a continual instruction. Many of the students that I taught as seniors in high school in 1999 had been in high school 7 or 8 years. Why? Because they'd be in school for 6 months and then they'd be over in Cote d'Ivoire as refugees for 18 months. They'd come back. They had no continual learning. So the educational system is just terrible. Now, how can we do that? That certainly can be done by educational people. but certainly, you know, teacher training. And not everything concentrated in Monrovia or at Cuttington, to have really teacher training programs throughout the country and to do that very, very quickly. The educators, I know they can do that, and they can do it very, very quickly and do it very, very well. But without really a major input into education, I don't think Liberia is going to move forward. And that can be done well and relatively inexpensively. One of them is to provide textbooks for all students and teachers. If you give a Liberian a textbook and give them a chance to read, or her a chance to read, and to absorb the material, they learn. And it's almost impossible. You see teachers putting notes on the board, children copying notes. You know, 90% of the time in the school is just wasted on putting notes on the board and then copying them. They really need textbooks. And if students have textbooks, they will learn. Unemployment is massive. I lived in Monrovia in 95 and 96. I was there last January. I'm going back there next month. There are just no jobs. Now, we hope that this $520 million allocated will begin, when it begins coming into the economy, that it will help put some cash into the economy. People have money, don't have money even for food. They don't have money to send their children to school. I hope that when you have all types of ways that you can do construction projects. I realize that they need, you know, some bulldozers and major equipment. But if you pay $400,000 for a big Caterpillar tractor, then you have to have a driver and expensive fuel oil and lots of money for spare parts. I think a lot of things can be done by hand labor. If Liberians, when they do these constructions, and I'm not saying you can't be cost effective, but to try to take positions that are labor intensive, so as many people will begin to get work and be able to get their families and their economies going again. Like in the area I come from, the reopening the Firestone plantation, I'm not a big backer of Firestone, I'm a big backer of plantation, but they are major employers and it's a steady employment and it brings money into the economy. They have a big, huge palm oil plantation. It was in Cape Palmas, World Bank money. I think it's there for 20 years. To this day, they have never been able to use it because of the warfare. The palm trees are just there. People use them locally, but there's no work there. So to get those Liberia is really ideally suited for agriculture. It's, you know, 12 months growing period. It has rain between 100 and 200 inches a year, depending upon where you are. So there's plenty of rain, and so it's suited for agriculture and especially for tree crops. I remember when I was there first, seeing people bring in cocoa and coffee to be processed for export. Now, this was never a major export, but again, this puts people don't need much. If they have a few coffee trees, they get $30 or $40 or $50, $100 a year. They can pay the children's school fees. They can do, especially in the rural areas, a little bit of money goes a long way. I would say on recognizing and utilizing local problem-solving structures. Liberians solve problems. There were no courts in Cape Palmas where I was recently. People solve the problems. I've seen my idea is if the people can solve the problems in the towns and the villages, they should be solved there. If it comes in the towns, they should be solved there. Only the central government should come in to solve problems or to resolve situations, which they cannot be done. Now, some people will say that this 20 or 25 years of civil disruption that social structures have deteriorated to the point that we have almost chaos. I don't hold that at all. I think social structures are very resilient. All we have to do is look at the former Soviet Union after 70 years of trying to preach atheism and to preach no ethnic identity. As soon as the Soviet Union went down, we saw people back into the religious mode, and also all of the Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, all of the smaller countries that they forced for 70 years to become Russian, they were gone. the social structures in Liberia, I'm convinced, are there, and I see them working in times of trouble, sickness, marriages, death. The social units go. So social units are resilient. One of the things, unfortunately, in Liberia, the tradition of involving youth in decision-making is just, I don't think it's been there. Now, somebody may say they come from the rural areas, it might have been in there, but it has not been there. So, and youth really can do it and should be involved in decision-making, and they're not. Just a few concluding ones. When I say that that Liberians are nonviolent people, I always bring up the part of West Point, Liberia. Now, West Point is not like West Point on the Hudson. It's a vast, densely populated peninsula that juts out into the ocean in Monrovia. Some people say it's about 40 acres of land, and there's 60,000 people living there. The houses are so close together that you can't carry a bucket of water on your head going between them. Almost every ethnic group in Liberia has a quarter or a section there. Crime is, I'm not saying it's wonderful, it's promised land, but the police station there is probably about as big as this room. They have four cells and about 10 policemen on duty. For 60,000 people living in abject poverty in very, very densely populated area. If you had that here in the United States, you'd have to bring out the National Guard. And so the people there, they are peaceful and they will rule. If they're giving some type of a basic structure, I'm very, very confident that the social structure in Liberia, given the minimum of civil protections by a good civil society, that Liberia really will come into the forefront, not in the very, very near future, but I think the basic elements are there for a better Liberia.
David Haberstein in War in a Time of Peace writes, harsh authoritarian controls and systems did not merely limit political, intellectual, and spiritual freedom, but economic freedom, and in the end limited the some strength and might of the state. This evening, we're looking at the state in Liberia. I have not come forward, or I'm not arrogant enough and presumptuous enough to put forth a design for a new state in Liberia. That is a task for the Liberians, and I'm one of them. Instead, I shall attempt to present some philosophical propositions for reinvention of the state in Liberia. These might serve as somewhat of a guidepost or a roadmap for creating a socially, politically, and economically viable and functional state in Liberia. The efforts at state building in Liberia has been ongoing for the past 150 years, going back to 1847. The 1847 Constitution was drafted, as we all been told, by Professor Simon Greenleaf of Harvard University, and it served as the basis for launching the first independent republic, and now known as Liberia and Africa's oldest republic. Following the military coup of April 12, 1980, and suspension of the 1847 Constitution, a new constitution was drafted by 1983 and became operational January 6, 1986, when Samuel Doe, the former master sergeant who staged the military coup in 1980, was inaugurated as Liberia's president. Now, despite a claim of, quote, within the possibilities of local cultures and institutions, the new constitution strove to establish, promote, and protect certain democratic values, norms, and predispositions, and to devise mechanisms for the evolution or configuration of institutions to ensure the functioning of a democratic society. But like its 1847 constitution, this constitution was also seriously flawed conceptually and in implementation. These defects led to the fraudulent 1985 elections, followed by the November 1985 attempted coup led by Thomas Kumapua, and the aftermath, which paved the road leading to the catastrophe of the period 1989 to 1997. Testifying before a joint U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Africa and Human Rights, then Assistant Secretary of State Dr. Chester Crocker said, "Moreover, the November attempt and its aftermath opened Liberia to the prospect of the kind of tribal, ideological, and violent politics that bedeviled the rest of the continent, but that has not been part of Liberia's political history." Well, that political violence materialized by 1989 and has left some 300,000 Liberians dead, has sent a third of the country's population of 3 million into exile, and has wrecked the economy and put into the executive mansion a former warlord as president. All of this in a period of 14 years now provides an opportunity for Liberians to engage each other in a healthy, open debate on just what kind of people Liberians want to be and what kind of state they want to live in. Let me give you one example why this debate is urgent. In Chapter 1, Article 1 of the Liberian Constitution, it states, "All power is inherent in the people. All free governments are instituted by their authority and for their benefit, and they have the right to alter and reform the same when their safety and happiness so require. In order to ensure democratic government which respond to the wishes of the governed, the people shall have the right at such period and in such manner as provided for under this constitution to cause their public servants to leave office and to fill vacancies by regular elections and appointment." Unquote. If all power is inherent in the people, why are the people constrained or restricted to only altering or reforming their government and not creating new ones if the government they have formed failed to live up to the responsibilities they were supposed to serve? The Constitution also says, quote, "In order to ensure democratic government which respond to the wishes of the governed." Who are the governed? I thought the Constitution created two classes of people: those in whom all power is vested, the ultimate authority, and therefore the governors, and two, those who are the public servants, and therefore the servants of the people. So why are we talking about those governed? How come the servant becomes the master over the owner? There are no procedures and no mechanisms designed and put in place by the Constitution for the people to exercise their power over their public servants. There are no recall procedures, no referendum, no ombudsman institution for the people to bring their public servants to account. These conditions and much more require that Liberians re-examine the whole idea of the state. The problems of Liberia for the past 150 years are inherent in the state. So what exactly is this thing? Who owns it? To whom does it account? In other words, who exercises ultimate control or power over the state? Is the state autonomous from the people? Who participates in the state? Under what conditions? There is no consensus on these and many other more questions among people who have looked at the state. The other thing, of course, is that Liberia has not been without a state of its own. Those who make the case that there are stateless people in Liberia mistake what is the reality on the ground. Those who are said to be stateless are people who are fiercely democratic, distrust executive powers, and therefore decentralize power prior to the arrival of the state, or what is called now the Western State and the beginning of Liberia. There were people who maintain order. There were people who resolve conflicts. There were people who took into their hands the whole affairs of managing and controlling their social affairs. So these are functions that the state formed. So why does someone arrive at the conclusion that because there's no king, there's no chief, but that there are social controls that limit and constrain the behavior of their members, and that those members adhere to those norms, and therefore you have peace, stability, control, order? Why would someone think that because there's no king, but these functions and these conditions exist, that there's no state? There are several views of the state, the Western state, that is. The pluralist state perspective is that it is a neutral arena. And in this arena, there are competition for authoritative allocation of values and resources. The elitist critique of the pluralist perspective is that the state remains an arena, but it is biased in favor of the rich and the powerful. And there's the Marxist perspective that the state is organized as a cohesive mechanism. It operates to resolve problems arising from social competition and interaction and control. According to David Gordon, the state serves two structural functions: securing and maintaining control and order, and facilitating economic activities. The Western state wasn't needed to do these, to perform these functions or structures. They were already being performed. In Simone Weil, in Oppression and Liberty, she makes the case, quote, "Every human group that exercises power does so, not in such a way as to bring happiness to those who are subject to it, but in such a way as to increase that power. It is a matter of life and death for any form of domination whatsoever." What we have seen in Liberia and in other several African countries is over what one can call the bottom line. Who gets what? How much? When? Under what conditions? And who is excluded? So we're down to basically the culture. And Larry Diamond makes the case in Developing Democracy that a people's predominant beliefs, attitudes, values, ideals, sentiments, and evaluation about the political system of their country and the role of the self in that system is the basis for the functioning of a state, a democratic state. On this basis, we put forth a few philosophical propositions. One, a national conference is needed for Liberia and for Liberians so that they can re-examine the context in which they want to operate and to redefine themselves. Two, Liberians want an organic state, not a mechanistic state, an organic state that is evolving from their history and cultures. Three, Liberians are concerned about liberty and freedom, and they want to live in a polity that will ensure and enlarge their liberty and freedom and not constrain them. There are Liberian societies that are fiercely democratic, and they distrust executive powers. For this reason, they do not allow any major decision to be made in secret. They want an open forum where these matters are discussed. And all participate, men, women, children. Liberians want to maintain cultural identities. There is nothing incompatible with being a Kron, a Kru, a Mano, or Bassa, and being a Liberian at the same time. The silly notion that in order to be a Liberian, one must cast off any identity or any claim to identity to a cultural group is certainly not one that will create a harmonious, peaceful, and socially viable, conflict-free society for all Liberians. Liberians want a state in which nationalities are recognized and represented proportionately in public life. Ethiopia has moved ahead in what I consider a very radical solution to the conflict in Africa, and Ethiopia, 30 years of conflict with Eritrea, I guess, sets the basis for this. Nationalities exist in Liberia and in other African states. The recognition of those nationalities, they call them tribes, they're not. They have languages of their own, they have social structures of their own, they have institutions that resolve conflict, that manage conflict, and control social arrangement among the members. We should recognize those nationalities and have them incorporated in a new constitutional framework. Liberians want free, open discussion in their polity as a means of creating and maintaining true democracy. And finally, Liberians want a federated state as opposed to a unitary state, and they want to decentralize state power so that each county can have its own assembly, elect its own officials, levy taxes, and there can be revenue sharing. I sum up by saying what Liberians need most of all and what the conflict is about is not ethnicity. It's about power sharing. Who participates on what basis? Who gets what is available and how much of it? And an equitable distribution of that. These propositions, if they are seriously incorporated into a new framework, will bring peace and stability and a viable state to Liberia. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Madam Perry, will you honor us with your comments, please?
Ladies and gentlemen, I highly appreciate the enlightening perspectives just given by our learned speakers on this panel in regards to making Liberia a more stable, governable, and peaceful state. The ruins of Liberia today resulting from more than a century of misrule and more than a decade of civil war, are a glaring indication of a state gone astray. Before Liberia moves to reinvent the state, we must go back and look at previous measures that existed before the war and reinstate them into effective measures. To my mind, the state of affairs in Liberia demands a sober reassessment and reevaluation of the system, methodology, and procedures we as a people have employed in initiating, maintaining, and sustaining the Liberian state. Accordingly, reinventing the state must first begin with the reinvention of Liberians themselves, who are both owners and builders of the state. We must once and for all discard and abandon the age-old divisive notion and practice of class and ethnicity, which for more than a century and a half have proven to be a terrible curse upon the state. Undoubtedly, many of the negative things that have happened in Liberia have often been the result of various groups having self-centered attitudes and thinking themselves better than the other groups of people. Liberians must therefore learn to acknowledge and appreciate unity in diversity. As a matter of fact, discrimination and exclusion on the basis of class, ethnicity, religion, etc., ought to be a crime punishable under the laws of Liberia. Once Liberians begin to regard, accept, and treat one another as fellow citizens with equal rights, the following measures, among many other things, could easily be taken to reinvent the state. One, providing educational opportunities, free and compulsory primary and high school education for every child, boy or girl. Two, protecting the basic freedoms and civil liberties of the people. And what do I mean by that? That means the people who govern should be made to know that the people must have their civil liberties to participate in carrying on the work of the government. Empowering of local government by national governments to facilitate mass participation of citizens at county levels in local productivity and development. Of all, it used to be like that in the 19th century, let me put it that. But during the 20th century, I can tell you, in fact, there was no government really ruling in the counties. They took advantage that whatever was the taxes that were taken from the people were not used for the people within that county. There was no sharing of it. So there was this devastated county or counties in Liberia. For example, local tax funds must be kept in the local community. That's what I mean. It should be kept there so that the people will enjoy some of what they have given out. Instead, it was all held by the central government. Then fourth, ensuring the independence of the legislature and judiciary to prevent their manipulation by the executive branch of government. For long, we don't know, since the coup took place, we don't know whether we have an independent legislature, an independent judiciary, because it's always being manipulated by the executive branch of government. Put in people they know. We know government put in people they trust. But man, let it be a government of inclusion. Let everybody partake to discuss and move the country forward. And five, appointing of a committee. This is something I'm suggesting, and I think it's appropriate, and I'm sure my learned lawyer will agree with me. Appointing of a committee of constitutional and legal scholars to review the Constitution and to present it to the legislature body before a referendum by the people of Liberia. For so long, we've been playing with the Constitution in Liberia. We haven't really played the role that the Constitution says, let the people have their say, let the people have their freedom of movement, etc. There's always a problem there. Previously, leaders changed the Constitution to suit themselves, as I was saying, and they changed it to their liking. We believe that the Constitution that was through referendum in the 1980s, we felt that there were so many mistakes that were made within that Constitution, and I believe that's why some of the problems are there today. The Constitution needs to be revamped by the people and modified to fit present-day realities and not the realities of individual leaders. This is how we look at it, and we need to enforce that. Six, again, ensuring the 100% disarmament of all combatants in Liberia prior to election, as well as ensuring that they are subsequently rehabilitated, reintegrated, and resettled, reconstituting and training members of the armed forces of Liberia and members of the paramilitary groups. We had that on our program before we turned over. But unfortunately, when Mr. Taylor came into power, he felt that his government was a sovereign, the Liberian government, or Liberia was a sovereign country, so he had the power to do what he wanted to do, and he didn't allow us to go into retraining, restructuring the army and the paramilitary groups. Seven, again, we say demanding accountability from all public officials and requiring them to make full restitution of stolen public, private properties, funds, etc. Now, we know, we who are from Liberia, we know what has been happening with officials of government. You check now, as he rightly said, the comforts of Liberia is diminished. They can't inform or give us any information as to how they are working in terms of the economy or what. That's why they owe so many months of payment and are paying the civil servants. And this is something that we say those people should be brought to trial, and those who are responsible, they must know very well that they have to face the crimes which they have committed and to bring them to trial. And we also want them to bring back into the cover what they have stolen. So many things, they go see vacant land. Those in power, they just grab those lands and start bidding on them. You dare not ask questions, you'll be in trouble. And then, in fact, they classify you as against the government or against the state. So what I want to say here before I close is that the children, which you wondered as to how they got involved into fighting, killing, we all know from Liberia that these children were drugged. They were drugged, they were given food, they were even given stipend. If a boy is giving a $10 bill, inject some drug into him, which we don't know where it was coming from, but the warlord should know, those guys will look at you as an animal and kill you just like that. Well, even ask you, who are you? Once they went on a rampage like that with their drugs, taking drugs, and girl, I tell you, Those were some of the reasons why we had boys going into that. And they can even look at each other and kill each other if they don't agree with what their partner has said, and they start arguing. When you look, shooting takes place. And that's how things went. To conclude, I would like to say if we Liberians now begin to sincerely live out the truth meaning of our National Pledge of Allegiance, which in part states, and I quote, "One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all," we will then be very well truly on our way to reinventing our state in the supreme interests of our people. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming out, and join me again in thanking our panel, Her Excellency Rusando Perry, Tom Hayden, and my colleague Patrick Sion. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the second of three panel discussions being presented by Boston University's African Studies Center and the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Tonight's discussion was entitled Reinventing Liberia. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Perotti and Tim Skog with help from Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.